This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we like to bring you every kind of story possible. The arts, public policy, love, death, and, well, sometimes just the plain old silly. And we want to lead off with the silly tonight. Well, because it's time. We need some silly. And we all always need some silly. And, well, we want to talk about a crazy commentator and a honey badger. If you're a fan of viral videos, chances are you've come across the work of our next guest. He calls himself Randall, and he's made himself famous by narrating nature videos in his own distinctive style. This video, The Crazy Honey Badger, has landed over 80 million views on YouTube alone. Let's take a listen.
This is the honey badger. Watch it run in slow motion. Look, it runs all over the place. Whoa, watch out, says that bird. Ew, it's got a snake. Oh, it's chasing a jackal. Oh my gosh. Oh, the honey badgers are just crazy. The honey badger has been referred to by the Guinness Book of World Records as the most fearless animal in all of the animal kingdom. If it's hungry, it's hungry. Ew, what's that in its mouth? Oh, it's got a cobra. Oh, it runs backwards. Now watch this. Look, a snake's up in the tree. Honey badger don't care. It just takes what it wants. Whenever it's hungry, it just, ew, and it eats snakes. Oh my God, watch it dig.
Oh my goodness. Our producer, Jesse Edwards, had a chance to talk with Randall today about how he got into doing these narrations and what he's doing to help protect endangered species.
Internet sensation Randall, the voice of the honey badger, is here to talk with us about saving endangered animals. TakePart.com has teamed up with Randall for the third annual Rare and Ready to be Saved March Madness bracket, all to save endangered species. Randall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
With 80 million views, I'm sure you've probably been asked 80 million times, how and why, first before we get to the brackets, how and why did you come up with this awesome concept to narrate nature films?
Well, you know, I've always had a real deep love for animals and narrating things. You know, my father was a cameraman for Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, and he would just come home when I was a child with so much footage, and I would just go to town trying to do my best Marlon Perkins. And years later, here I am, a failed playwright, not knowing what to do with myself, and my assistant is like, come on over, I have footage of a honey badger. And the rest is kind of history. I just went to town. I knew some fun facts about the honey badger, and for me, it was just a way to have fun and also raise awareness for an animal that, frankly, at the point of making that video, was on the brink of endangerment, and now they flourish. So all I'm trying to do is basically just raise awareness through humor and love.
That's awesome. And you released this like back in 2011. How quickly did it take off into the stratosphere?
I mean, it really took off like hotcakes. There was no rhyme or reason. I really didn't think that anything was going to happen with it, but it just, I mean, within the first couple of weeks, it was up to like maybe 500,000, and then it just kind of blossomed. It was amazing.
Now, do you do this full time? Has it blossomed into, you know, a full time job? Is this what you do all the time now? Have you been able to monetize this?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, the videos where I'm kind of coming up with my own footage, that, you know, that in the land of YouTube, that's where I can monetize. You know, I have to say, the honey badger video, it's not my footage, so I had to find ways to monetize, and that's the way you monetize. You know, you use your own original footage, and anyone out there listening that thinks that they can just hop on and get monetization, you know, you have to have original content in order to get that monetization from YouTube. But yeah, I mean, basically, this is what I've been able to do, and I'm very grateful for the opportunities I have to be able to just raise awareness for animals and share my love of animals. And I got to tell you, I received so many emails from students that are in school, and they, you know, all their wishes for me to be their biology teacher. So it's really fantastic. I mean, I'm just so happy to be in this position to help raise awareness.
Yeah, that's really cool. I saw somebody on your Facebook page said that she had a honey badger bumper sticker on her car, and that some guy asked her about it, and they ended up talking over and over again and ended up getting married. So you're bringing people together in all sorts of different ways. That's pretty cool.
That's amazing. Love found through the honey badger.
Tell us about this TakePart.com third annual Rare and Ready to be Saved. What's going on there? How does it work?
Now, this is fantastic. Basically, Take Parts teamed up with the Endangered Species Coalition, and there are 16 animals that are all endangered, four rounds. And, you know, for someone like myself with the March Cray craze, you know, everyone goes crazy with these brackets and the NCAA teams. And for me, I really only know animals. So it's perfect for someone like me. And basically, you know, for every 10 votes received from the public, Take Part donates a dollar to the Endangered Species Coalition, up to $5,000. And that money is going to go help to protect their habitat and their environments and let them flourish once again. So, I mean, it is fantastic. Anyone can visit takepart.com/animalbracket and vote as many times as they want.
Nice. What's next for Randall the Honey Badger Voice?
Just a lot more narration, a lot more raising awareness for animals. You know, now more than ever, I just find in our society there are just so many people that live in bubbles and they aren't really aware of what's going on in the animal kingdom. So, for me, I'm just going to keep keeping on with this sort of thing. And what's great about this animal bracket is whichever animal wins, I'm going to narrate a special video about that animal.
Nice.
So for me, I'm just so excited because it could be any one of these. It could be the pangolin, it could be the bog turtle, or the California condor. So for me, it's just more of the same, narrating more animals. I may get a little political every now and then. I do get political, and I've received so many notices from people that, oh, you have to narrate this about this person and this and about this person. But, you know, lately I've just been trying to keep my head out of anything political because it's just too crazy.
Yeah. Have you ever been approached about doing, like, a regular cable show or anything like that? Have you ever thought about it?
I would love to. I would absolutely love to. I mean, I think, you know, it's a new era, and I think folks are ready to learn about animals in a new, fun way. So, hey, if anyone's listening out there in TV land, give me a ring.
Give me a ring. Great job on that, Jesse. And sometimes we just want to get goofy. Honey Badger don't care, but we do. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after this. Great job on that, Jesse. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we cover every kind of story and every walk of life, from the arts, music particularly we love, the culture, life and death, love, marriage, stories always, and we like to dig into our college campuses. And if you want to really hear a funny story and get a good therapeutic laugh, go to our website, ouramericannetwork.org, and check out the segment we did with Roger Kimball in his Wall Street Journal column, The Rise of the College Crybullies. It was terrific, and something strange has been going on our campuses for quite a number of years in this country, where certain thoughts are just not getting rise and getting a space to give expression to, and others, well, they're free license to do what they want. And today we're being joined by Paul Miller, the head of the News and Policy Group at the Chaim Soloman Center. And thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, tell us about your recent article on TheObserver.com and what's going on at Purdue University over the past few years and even more recently.
Well, right now what you have seen is a situation with not just Purdue but campuses in general where you're having, you know, this whole boycott Israel situation. And oh, my God. Guys, you've been quiet all day.
I think we're going to keep this. This is too good, Paul.
Well, for all I care, you can keep it running.
That's terrific.
It's real life. Well,
by the way, and we love dogs. By the way, often we have the dogs right here in the studio, so no worries, Paul. The audience is laughing with us, so no worries. But pipe those puppies down.
So, yeah, we're going to do that. Let me.
So, but carry on. You're at Purdue University. There's this Boycott Israel movement. What's this about? Why are people boycotting Israel? And who are these people? And why are they picking on Israel and not all the other evil regimes around the world like Iran?
Well, you know what? That really is the that's the $64,000 question now, isn't it? You know, campuses that you're seeing at Purdue, which what we saw over there is a situation where you had academics that are basically putting out all this anti-Israel and really borderline, some would say, anti-Semitic rhetoric, and it's leading to incidents of anti-Semitism. And why, whether it's Purdue or at Oberlin or Vassar or the majority of the University of California campuses, the reason they're doing it is that for some reason they have decided that Israel is just like the United States, an imperialist empire that the left despises. And make no mistake, there's nothing about these groups that are boycotting Israel or are advocating to boycott Israel that want to do anything to improve the lives of Palestinians. It's not about that. It's only about delegitimizing the Jewish state, who they have now decided to portray as the big, most evil entity on the planet, if you can believe it.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Paul, is as ISIS runs around and roams around the Middle East and Africa, killing not only Christians in mass and creating a genocide, and I almost hate to use that word because it's overused, mm-hmm. but it's approximating close to something that would appear to be a genocide, and is also killing hundreds of thousands of their own, Muslims, that is. And yet this is the big deal? The state of Israel? How can that be today? I can understand 10 years ago anti-Americanism and anti-Israel sentiment tied together, but with what we know now, doesn't this just look silly?
Sure. Well, you're talking about common sense and decency. And when has that ever been part of the international conversation? I mean, when have we ever learned from the mistakes of the past? You call it silly. I know it's silly. But the sad thing is that whether it's Europe or now the political left, which, you know, is supposedly, you know, the great open-minded people of the left, they have decided that Israel or Zionism is racist, and Israel, for some reason, is now committing this, what they would refer to as now it's an apartheid state. But they tend to ignore the atrocities being committed against other Muslim groups, you know, and obviously these terrorist groups. And the idea of the fact that these guys are murdering in mass other Muslims, that is not important to them as long as they can blame Jews. And think about that. Think about what I just said there. But it's so true, and it's so disturbing that it's like they don't care how many of their own they have to sacrifice as long as they can portray Jews in some horrible, evil light. And that's indisputable because we see it, sadly, almost every day.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I rarely do any media hits, but I'd written a column on this subject, and CNN invited me on. And I just always like to ask questions back. And I just asked the moderator, who was on with Chris Cuomo, where in the Middle East would you rather be gay, a woman, or Christian? Name me the place.
Sure.
And sure. She didn't want to answer the question. She said, no, but that I asked the questions. I said, who says? A guest is allowed to ask a question. And the totalitarian nature often of the media on this subject, too, is pretty remarkable. There's not a real honest dialogue going on almost anywhere, frankly, is there, Paul?
No, there isn't. There isn't an honest dialogue. And of course, you know, this is being led by the political left and, of course, their followers in the media. And, you know, you brought up an interesting point about if you're a minority, whether you're a Christian, a member of the GLPT society, you know, where would you want to live in the Middle East? And the only answer to that is Israel. Well, they've taken it a step further where groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, Code Pink, Jewish Voice for Peace, if you can believe something like that, they all say that Israel's gay rights, the fact that, you know, gays in Israel actually have more freedom than they really do in the United States. I mean, Israel's like a decade ahead of the rest of the world,
yep.
If that's something you believe in. They call it pink washing. They claim that Israel only permits gay rights in the Jewish state as a cover to the quote-unquote atrocities being committed against Palestinians.
Of course.
So gay rights is just it's a facade. It's a cover to cover up their other inhumane acts.
Yeah, I've heard that code pink line. It's the same line. Well, look, let's face it. The mobsters always did that. You know, the Italian mafia would spread some money around the East Village and Little Italy while, of course, killing people. But this is a very different thing than the state of Israel. I want to get back to Purdue University.
Yes, Arnold, I've never heard that analogy, the mafia and the state of Israel.
Exactly.
But, it's new. You learn something new every day.
Hey, you try. And then there's a whiteboard outside the American Studies office of Purdue University. On this whiteboard appeared a swastika accompanied by an anti-Semitic slur. This occurred this past March, a few weeks ago. Now, if this had happened to another racial minority or to a gay group, and by the way, rightfully so, there'd be hell to pay. What happened here?
Absolutely. You know, exactly. So basically you saw an anti-Semitic, you know, remark made on this whiteboard, and they tried kind of covering it up at Purdue that it wasn't really a big deal and so forth. But the problem they have at Purdue is that they have professors there who have a history of traveling around and condemning the Jewish state. You know, they're always trying to blame Israel for everything going on. In that part, in particular with Purdue, it had to do with the American Studies program faculty, and that's exactly where it occurred. And unfortunately, they just didn't come out and they didn't really condemn it at first. Granted, Purdue has not been necessarily a hotbed of anti-Semitism, but around the same time, you had something similar happen at University of Indianapolis, and coincidentally, we know that a anti-Israel boycott divestment sanctions bill failed to pass the student senate. And when that happened, suddenly you see this increase in anti-Semitism.
Yep.
And I got to point out something else. A new study just came out by a group out of California called the AMCA Initiative, where they showed that 99%, and that's right, 99% of college campuses that have at least one anti-Israel group have had incidents of anti-Semitism in the past year.
Unbelievable.
So when people claim it's not anti-Semitism, it's just anti-Israel, they're full of it.
Oh,
because
please.
The truth of the matter is that the result is always the same, and it's dangerous for Jews.
Indeed. Well, Paul, we appreciate your work. Continue to send stuff when you can to Alex. And by the way, we always want the dog on the air with you, because this is a pet-friendly zone. Paul Miller, thanks so much. The head of News and Public Policy Group at the Chaim Solomon Center. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Thank you.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. And thanks, Paul and his pup, for joining us. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And as often as possible, at least once a day when we can, we like to bring in the whole production crew. And that's Jesse, Alex, and Hengler. And I don't know why I always call Greg by his last name, but I just do.
I'm used to it.
And he's used to it. And I've always been called Habib, so it's just the way it is. It's just what guys do. But they're guys, too. I don't know. I don't even want to think about it too much. But we were talking about... Well, we were talking about some things, and when we talk about things, generally we watch Greg's body just react, and it contorts, and once that occurs, we pretty much know we have what we call a Hengler rant on our hands, and the discussion Well, this rant revolves around choosing an animal and choosing a car. Here's Hengler.
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of my rants, they come across as harsh, but I really am trying to do you a favor. And so what I'm going to be talking about here is these two very, I consider very, very important decisions because, you know, most of us when we choose an automobile or whether we choose a pet, you're talking at least, you know, what, 10 years? And there's two things in these decisions that really I think is a huge issue, and I think it ties into the Facebook culture. You know, let me put up this really cool quote by Anonymous on my Facebook page so I'll seem really smart and insightful. That's going into this world of very important decision-making of cars and pets. And number one, the car, I think, and the pet, the question we're asking is how is this decision going to make other people think of me instead of how is this decision going to improve me and my family's life? So we'll say, oh, I'm going to get a green car because you know what? People will think that I'm just really, you know, doing a good job to the environment and I'm being very green and environmentally friendly and conscious. And so I'm going to choose the green car without thinking about the second step. I have a friend and he calls this first stage thinking, Dennis Brager. And so there's a first stage, you know, what are the people going to think? And they'll do the same thing the other way. Let me get the Hummer, even though I only drive to work and back, you know, because other people will have good things to say about me. No, you're not making that decision. When we were looking to get a family car, we wanted to get a minivan. Ugh. And everyone was saying, a minivan, we got an SUV. We would say, how's that working out for you? Well, it's really hard getting in the kids' seats. And, you know, sometimes there's just not enough room. And we're like, that's why we want to get the minivan. We're not thinking about how cool it makes me look. We're thinking about how it's going to improve my life.
Yeah, but you don't drive the minivan.
Well, not to work. when I'm driving my family, I've been driving a minivan since I was a sophomore in high school, and all my friends would get in. It was fun. I never felt embarrassed about a minivan. I always actually thought it was cool. And so the whole people like, get an SUV. I was like, why? So people are getting the SUVs because the minivans doesn't look cool for them.
What do you drive to work?
The Ford Explorer.
An SUV.
Oh, right. Yeah. But, okay, let me defend it. I didn't buy it. And I would have bought a Honda. Anyway. So the pet. Now, here's a huge thing. We just got a dog about a year ago. And we, you know, it's a Woodle, a half Wheaton Terrier, half Mini Poodle. And it is a great dog. And we had all these things that we were looking for when we got it. You know, no shedding, no barking. Super friendly with kids. And we have run into so many people in the park who they say, you know, I love your dog. It's so cute. And it's so sweet. And where'd you get it again? And so we talked to them. We just haven't really been happy with our choice. We got ours from the rescue, and it's just not very friendly to other dogs, and it kind of snaps at our kids, and it just hasn't really been a good part of the family. And it's just, yeah, that's because you had this stage one thinking of what are other people going to think of me when they say, oh, you got a new dog, and you can tell them, oh, I got it from the rescue. Big deal. That praise is going to last a couple months. Now you're stuck with this mongrel for 10 years, and you know, all because you thought you would sound cool and because you'd post it up on Facebook and say, look at our latest dog. We got it from the rescue. Congratulations. Now you're stuck 10 years with this thing. Okay, if you're going to get it from the rescue, you have to be committed. You're going to have to go down there every single day and wait to see what the new crop of dogs that are going to be brought in until you finally find that perfect one. My brother did that. He actually worked at the Humane Society, and so he had 6 months of dogs to come in, and he finally picked out what I thought was one of the greatest dogs I've ever known. His name was Marley, and this dog was awesome. But most people just go down there and pick whatever is there, which is pretty much probably all rejects from somebody's house. And so you pick this dog, you bring it home, and it starts chomping on your baby. Congratulations! You can say you're a good person for getting the rescue dog. It only works for cats, because all cats are the same.
Hey,
they're all the same. They're all just gonna poop in your house, and they're gonna walk away. Whenever I think of a cat, I always have those Siamese twins from Lady and the Tramp in my head who are just beasts. And that's what cats are. So, anyway, that's the problem that we're having is the cars and the animals. Come on, people. Take it seriously and be practical about it. Don't let narcissism get in the way of pragmatism.
There you go.
And
there
it's the people that let their cats go to the bathroom in the house with the litter box. I mean,
yeah.
There's no way you're hiding that smell. You're not fooling anybody. Febreze is not going to fix it.
No, well, it's
even,
not.
You know what? And even if you can hide the smell, everyone knows that where that cat's feet are.
Oh.
And then they're going to walk around. Even if you can't see those little specks, they're all over your house.
They
are.
Yeah.
Now we're looking over our...
Come here and pet me, please. Now get away from me.
Most cats are jerks in general, but every once in a while you get that one that's just awesome.
Oh, yeah.
It opens cabinets, it flushes the toilet.
The dog cat.
Yeah.
The dog cat, yeah.
Yeah, we call them dog cats.
They actually hang out when you pet them and don't, like, just come up for a second, let you rub them.
And then bite you.
Yeah, and then bite you.
So you're basically saying, Hengler, about the minivan. By the way, do you remember in Get Shorty? Where Travolta is
the Cadillac of minivans.
The Cadillac of minivans, and pretty soon everyone's driving minivans because the second they get into it, they're going, this is really nice.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, who else? And of course, he drove the minivan because he had no other option, but he was so cool, he made the car cool.
Yeah.
And then the back lots of all the studios had minivans parked behind them and out with the Ferraris. It was great.
Yep.
So you're saying a guy like me, for instance, I mean, I don't have a minivan, but I only got one kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we went the SUV route. So what are you saying to all the SUV owners out there who have like 4 or 5 kids? Is it just a fashion statement they're making, or are you just...
Well, I think I would just simply ask them and let them condemn themselves, because I would say, is there enough room? And they'd probably say no. And I'd say, why did you get it? You know, why did you get it then?
I think it's just so much more feminine looking, I think, than an SUV. I mean, an SUV looks like you're going to work.
Again.
An SUV likes you. You might be driving through the forest. A minivan says you're driving to a soccer practice.
Yep.
And it's just, it just looks.
But I think this reinforces Hengler's point, is that we're worried about how we look. And he's saying we're superficial and shallow, Jesse, you and I, for cavorting around this way, that we should be comfortable in our manliness and our masculinity, and we should just be in that minivan and just feeling fine about it.
Well, and there's two sides of this coin, because in the car world, the looks I don't think really matter. So get the minivan, who cares how it looks? But in the animal world, you got to look at this dog all the time. It better be doggone cute.
Yeah.
And most of these dogs at the rescue aren't that cute.
Well,
my brother's dog is pretty darn cute. It was really cute. But I'm just saying, in general, these are mutts. They're bleh, you know. Get the dog that
they've made it virtually impossible to buy a dog from somebody, even if they're just breeding it because their dog had puppies and they want to sell them. People look down at you like you're running a puppy farm yourself, and they've made it almost illegal to go out and some places, some states, it's virtually illegal to go buy a dog. They want you, they force you to go buy it from the shelter. And you used to be able to get a dog for free from the shelter. Now you have to pay upwards of $200 sometimes for a rehoming fee, they call it.
Rehoming.
And I understand they got to pay for it, but man, don't look down at me because I want to buy a dog from somebody else.
Yep.
Well, there you have it here on Our American Stories. We sometimes like to dig into some of the things that are bothering our crew here, and particularly whatever's bothering Hengler really amuses us. Sometimes we just shake our heads, and other times he makes us laugh. Hopefully, the same for you. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for news, turn the dial. Hot talk, people screaming and yelling at each other, you got the wrong station. But if you're looking for stories, good writers, arts, music, American life, well, then you got the right place. Take a seat and take a listen. One of our favorite papers in the country is a paper that I wish almost had a different name, because it says the Wall Street Journal on it. You're thinking, oh boy, I've got to either trade or buy and sell stocks or be a CEO to read this paper. But it's got one of the best opinion papers in the country, where you learn a lot of stuff. And then the personal journal, oh my goodness, I don't even start with the news. I go right to that section. And I like to call it America's Journal. And I particularly like following some of the young writers. And we like young people here on Our American Stories. We don't think the 20-something generation is the worst generation of all time, because every generation has said that about every successive generation. And it's nonsense. And one of the young writers that's doing a great job over at the Wall Street Journal is Kyle Peterson. And Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
You bet. You know, Kyle, this last piece that you did for the Journal, well, tell us a little bit about it. You called it the Great American Disconnect. What's this disconnect about?
Well, it's a sorting of people into different geographical areas by political consideration. So one of the examples that I used in the piece was the suburbs of Washington, D.C. When I moved to D.C. a few years ago, I was looking for a place. You know, if you don't want to live in the city, you want a little bit of elbow room, you really have two choices. You can go to Virginia and you can go to Maryland. And for me, it wasn't even, you know, I didn't even have to think about it with the taxes and the gun laws in Maryland. You know, I didn't even bother looking there. So there's been some research that suggests there's a lot of this sorting going on over time, slowly. Red states getting redder, blue states getting bluer. And then the focus of the piece was on an intentional version of this. So in 2001, a guy by the name of Jason Sorens, who was a Yale grad student at the time, he was a strong libertarian, and he came up with this idea. He said, the Libertarian Party gets a couple million votes in the 2000 election, but they're geographically spread out. So what we need to do is we need to converge on a sparsely populated state and essentially hijack the state government. We can get a lot of stuff done. So 15 years later, it's been a long road. The plan was to get 20,000 pledges to move, and they just hit that mark in February. And 2,000 people have already moved. About 40 of them have been elected to the state legislature in New Hampshire. There's about 20 of them in the state legislature right now. So they're having an impact.
That's fascinating. And for our listeners, and we don't do hard politics here at all or very often, but we do like to do stories about demographics and where people are moving from and to. One of the most interesting stories, Kyle, that we follow is the annual Atlas Van Lines. Where are people moving to and where are they moving from issue? And they simply track where those trucks are going to and loading up to and where they're dropping stuff off at. And it is a really interesting story about stuff leaving blue states and being dropped off at red states. And so that's a fascinating story. Tell me, who are libertarians? What do they believe? I mean, we hear the word. How do they differ from Democrats and Republicans? Who are these folks called libertarians?
Well, they would say, I believe, that they put the first and foremost focus on freedom. So what they mean by that is economic freedom and individual freedom. So they see themselves as neither on the left nor on the right. I mean, the people in this that I was talking about who have been moving as part of this free state project, it's called, I mean, they're serious libertarians. They want to decriminalize marijuana up there. And a bill that to that effect has passed the state house a couple times, though it has not gotten past the governor's veto. They want to legalize prostitution. That would be the personal side. Then on the economic side, I mean, they want to cut taxes. They want school choice. They want, I would argue, they'd probably be for right to work laws. So you could see how, if you are a libertarian, if you subscribe to that viewpoint, how you would be perpetually frustrated by politics wherever you live, because some of those ideas went out some places and others other places, but nowhere is this philosophy in anywhere close to full effect. So that was really their goal. And there'd been some other efforts along these lines too. I mean, libertarians for decades have been talking about where they can create a polity of their own. There have been some, what they call it, seasteading, this idea that maybe we can build some sort of a floating platform in international waters that we can
right.
go and live on and live according to our principles. So this has been a new idea, but this is the first instance where it's being put into practice in a way that seems to be working.
Well, and you know, this is a distinctly American thing anyway. I mean, look, from our founding onwards, from the Mayflower, where people were just looking to get a little bit of the land of their own and live amongst their own, to immigrant groups. I'm Italian, half Italian, half Lebanese. Lebanese clustered with Lebanese. Italians formed their own little enclaves from St. Louis to New York City. And look at the Amish or the Mormons. They form their own little spots, but you're saying here this is more than cultural identity. We're looking at political enclaves starting to form along ideology, and it sounds to me, Kyle, that you're saying libertarians aren't quite comfortable with the big government approach of the left, and yet they don't like the social implications of the right often imposing their let us say private views on what is private conduct. And am I getting that right?
Right, exactly. One of the things that's interesting about it is they are, as a rule, incredibly thoughtful. I mean, you can disagree with some of those positions, but most libertarians, because this is not a mainstream political view, they have migrated to that view after doing some serious reading. And a lot of them have read, you know, economists, Mises, they sort of know what they're talking about.
Yep. Yeah, I've found that to be the case. Probably some of the smartest folks I've ever met are libertarians, and I might not agree with them, but my goodness, have they thought out their positions. Now, so they've occupied this state. The 20,000 got triggered. What are they hoping to accomplish in this state? What's a win for them? What are they looking to do in the end?
Well, I think what they're looking to do in the end is to push that vision through. So the executive director or the president of the organization, the Free State Project, told me that her vision is for a Yankee Hong Kong or, you know, maybe a Yankee Switzerland. So that's the long-term view, 20, 30 years down the line, if they can keep this migration moving. But Mr. Sorens, the founder, told me also that he I think the quote was something to the effect of, he said, "I'm desperate for victories for liberty, and I will take moving the ball down the field, even 5 yards. So some of the things, like I said, he said that in the past 5 years, he thinks that the state has become substantially more free. I mean, they weakened teacher tenure. The state legislature cut the business tax over the next 5 years. So there has been some of that progress. And the question, I think, is, like I said, there's 2,000 who have moved right now. There's 20,000 pledged. How many of those people will wind up coming?
Right.
The Free State Project organizer said they expect about 6,000 more within the next 5 years. So if you do the math on that, I mean, there's 2,000 of them now and 20 currently in the legislature. If you get 6,000 more movers, that could make a huge difference.
You bet. And hopefully these libertarians can get busy and have some kids, and that can do it too. Right, Kyle?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is definitely a community atmosphere. I went to the Free State Project annual Liberty Forum up in Manchester, New Hampshire, last month. And I was surprised at how many kids were running around. One of the things they do when new movers come is they set them up with people from the Free State Project who are living in their area, other movers. And you know, you heard talk of people driving from other states. They don't know anybody. They show up at this new house that they've rented or bought. And there's 15 or 20 people who are also with the Free State Project who are there helping them unload. So it definitely is a community-based organization.
Well, and they have some fun, too. I like the whole Robin Hooding stuff that happens. Tell folks shortly about what Robin Hooding is, and I think I want to get this going in my own town.
Sure. So some of the more active, let's say, individuals in the group have centered in a town called Keene, New Hampshire. And one of the things they started doing was they would walk around town with change, and they would fill expired parking meters to prevent people from getting parking tickets. And, you know, I could see that, though though it seemed somewhat to spiral downward then. They started following the Meaner Maids around with cameras and videotaping them and harassing them a little bit. So I would, if you're gonna start this in your town, I would start the first half and leave the second. Yeah,
I think
out.
That's probably good. We don't have to
have alienated some of the people in the town.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, definitely an interesting idea.
We were talking to Kyle Peterson of the Wall Street Journal, and if you want to read a great paper, subscribe to the Wall Street Journal at WSJ.com. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all of what we do. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we cover every kind of story here, from the arts to sports and business. And recently, a great man of business died, a great innovator, Andy Grove, Intel chief, spurred semiconductor revolution, read the New York Times op-ed. And you're thinking, what's a semiconductor? Does he work on the railroad? And there was a revolution? Did I miss it? Well, here's what they wrote in the New York Times. Andy Grove, the longtime chief executive and chairman of Intel Corporation, who was one of the most acclaimed and influential personalities of the computer and internet era, died on his home in Los Altos, California. He was 79. At Intel, Mr. Grove helped midwife the semiconductor revolution, the use of increasingly sophisticated chips to power computers that proved to be as momentous for economic and social development as the development of hydrocarbon fuels, electricity, and telephones were in earlier eras. And this is the core of what Andy Grove did. Intel's microprocessors were also essential for digital cameras, consumer electronic products, household appliances, toys, manufacturing equipment, and a wide assortment of devices that depended on computerized functions. In short, no Intel, all the goodies we love, we don't have them. And that they've continued to get cheaper and smaller and faster and better. Because this is the other thing. And to allow us to live more freely, to connect with people we couldn't have connected to bring people closer together. I was just talking to a friend who said, you know, my husband's overseas, and if it weren't for FaceTime or Tango, my life would have been different. And wow, what a thing to do. And that's microprocessors allow all that stuff to happen. To talk to somebody in Afghanistan on a phone and to see them. Beautiful. Adding to Mr. Grove's appeal, however, and this is why we're doing an hour on this man, was his rags-to-riches immigrant story. And get this, he was a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust and the 1956 Soviet invasion of his native Hungary. So twice he had to deal with oppression. I mean, the Nazis should have been enough for anybody. But then his family gets oppressed and held hostage again in the Soviet invasion of Hungary. He arrives in the United States as a penniless youth who spoke little English and had severe hearing loss. But within decades, Grove was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And in 1997, he was chosen Man of the Year by Time Magazine for being, quote, the person most responsible for the amazing growth in the power and the innovative potential of microchips. Again, only in America some stories can happen, folks. Andy Grove was born as Andros Grof on September 12, 1936, into a Jewish household in Budapest. His father owned a small dairy business, and his mother helped keep the books. As a child, Grove was afflicted with scarlet fever and an ear infection that almost left him deaf. His father was rounded up by German troops occupying Hungary during World War II and sent to a labor camp, where he survived typhoid and pneumonia. Meanwhile, the young Mr. Grove and his mother were hidden by a Christian family until the war's end. And by the way, this happened throughout Europe. Again, the power of Christ's love to risk their own lives to hide a stranger. In the 1997 Time magazine interview, Mr. Grove recalled that at age 8, he was told by his mother to assume a Christian alias. She explained to me that I cannot make a mistake, that I had to forget my own name. Imagine growing up with something like that, folks, when you start to think about your own tough times. Liberated from Nazis, that was soon followed by communist rule in Hungary, and then by the Hungarian uprising of 1956 that was put down by Russian troops. Mr. Grove, who was studying chemistry, decided to flee the country after a number of his fellow students were arrested and imprisoned. He and a friend crossed the border into Austria after a night spent evading Soviet troops. Several weeks later, he boarded a refugee ship to New York and from there was taken to a former POW camp in New Jersey until his immigration papers were in order. Quote, "We thought that all the propaganda was true, that America was just another drab totalitarian state. That's what they taught us," Mr. Grove said in a 1995 interview. You see, folks, that's not made up. Mr. Grove, who was Americanized with his name within weeks, moved in with an aunt and uncle living in a small Bronx apartment. He enrolled as a chemical engineering student at City College of New York and graduated at the top of his class despite struggling with English and impaired hearing. Mr. Grove got through lectures by learning to read lips, then deciphering notes at home or at the library. Quote, "I had to go over each day's work again at night with a dictionary at my side." He told the New York Times in a 1960 article that focused on that year's outstanding CCNY graduates. And this is why we often talk about taking it too easy on people who have impediments. Look what can happen if you just let him rise above his own problems. In 1958, he married Ava, another Hungarian refugee, whom he met the previous summer at a New Hampshire resort where both worked as waiters. They moved to California together, where Mr. Grove earned a doctorate in chemical engineering at the University of California at Berkeley. They had two daughters, whose names were never revealed by the media because of Mr. Grove's insistence on protecting their lives from a voracious media. And then his life at Intel, what he did, how he managed to do it. He was a tough boss. He drove folks hard. And he also made hundreds, if not almost 1,000 people that worked for him, millionaires. And he said this towards the end of his life, "I've had a wonderful life," he told Wired magazine in a lengthy 2001 interview. "What people are going to write about me 10 years after I'm dead, who cares?" And so for the hour, we're going to talk about Andy Grove. We're going to focus in on one of his last interviews, one he gave Charlie Rose, about his book, about his memoir, which he finally wrote years after he left Intel, called Swimming Across. You'll get to know the man, his early life, particularly his family life, enough about his business life. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories for the Hour, the life of Andy Grove. Habib and the life of Andy Grove is being featured this hour on Our American Stories. What did they say, Greg? What was that one headline for Andy Grove? The man behind all your computer stuff?
Yeah.
That's about right. Semiconductors. No one knows what you're talking about. Microprocessors. The man behind all your computer stuff. We're going to talk about him for the rest of the show, but actually we're going to hear from him. And in 2001, he sat down with Charlie Rose to talk about a book he'd long avoided writing because he never wanted to publicize his own tough childhood. Like a lot of the survivors of the Holocaust, frankly, and a lot of people who survived World War II, it's hard to get these people to open up about the really, really deep, painful experiences they had. Why talk about it? Why go back, was their thinking. I got through it. And you'll learn why he decided to in this great book, Swimming Across. Here's Charlie Rose, and he tells his story in the memoir, Swimming Across. Why? What is he up to? Let's hear.
I became a grandfather, and the realization struck that by the time my grandchildren are going to be old enough to understand my story, I'll be too old to tell it to them. And my kids and my wife and my family and close friends have heard most of the stories in that book. Not in context, not in sequence, but they've heard them.
Not at one telling, so to speak.
Not in one telling, and not in an orderly fashion. So I had practiced telling the story in bits and pieces, but 20 years from now, the chances that I'll be able to tell those stories and do justice to them is less likely.
So that's why he wrote the book, for his granddaughter. He had his first grandchild. In 1997, when he was made Time Magazine Man of the Year, it was the first time he started to tell his remarkable story and his difficult early life.
That made a difference in the sense that that was the first time somebody got me to talk about it publicly at all. And so the two things actually, you're very correct, coincided. In late 97, Josh Ramo was the writer of the story, cracked through my reticence of talking about it in public, and in 97 I became grandfather for the first time, so I had an audience for this story. So I started thinking about it. So I told Time Magazine, and is Time Magazine the only thing I'm going to leave for my grandchildren? I can do it a bit better. At least I thought I could do a bit better. We'll see.
Yeah, he had to do better, is what I think he was thinking. Why didn't he talk about this early tragic life before?
Look, I've been on your show a number of times. You want to talk about technology, you wanted to talk about Intel, you wanted to talk about the industry.
I don't want to talk about you.
I didn't want to talk about circumstances like this. It's kind of, the two subjects have nothing to do with each other. Everybody has a past and a legacy. Mine happens to be including wars and repression and the like. I didn't want to use that to publicize my Intel story any more than I would like to use the Intel story today to publicize my personal story.
But it was that. It wasn't because it was something that the pain was too much or the sheer sense of retelling the story.
Not really, because then I wouldn't have told my family about it. It was never difficult to talk about it to an audience that I thought was interested, and my family was interested in it. I told it several times, this particular story. When I wrote the book, I wrote a sample chapter to see what the narrative would look like. And this chapter I chose was a story of how I got out of Hungary, how I got across the border. I chose that partly because it's dramatic, and partly because I've told that so many times that I thought it would be the easiest to tell, and it was easy to tell.
And then the conversation continues.
Harder to tell is when you saw your father coming back.
True. And some of the stories were even harder than that.
Like which ones?
My mother's encounter with Russian soldiers.
You were taken out of the room when...
Correct.
She was treated badly.
Yes.
And others?
I think the general sense of being persecuted, picked on, discriminated against because of being Jewish. It wasn't hard because... It was painful. It was hard because I was torn between, was I really discriminated against or am I whining about it? And I knew I was discriminated against, but when I talked about it, I didn't like myself complaining about it. I don't like complainers. I don't like to be a complainer. So it's a push and pull between wanting to talk about how I was treated, but feeling reticent to talk about it because of what it made me sound like.
Wow. I was almost moved to tears by that. He is a legitimate victim. He watched his mother get I don't even want to get into it. You'd have to read the book. But to say these Russian soldiers treated his wife, his mom poorly is the understatement of the century. On returning to his home, what does he want to go back to Hungary?
You have no interest in going back to Hungary.
Not really.
Not really.
No. No interest. The country where that never made me feel wanted when I was an ordinary kid growing up, student, high school student, university student, I was always reminded that I didn't belong there. So why should I want to go back there?
Yeah, that was my grandfather who left Lebanon through some religious battles. And I'd always asked him why he didn't go back. And he said, why would I want to go back? And then I sometimes expressed interest in going there. And he goes, don't go. I didn't want to go. Don't play curious boy wondering what Lebanon was like because you don't know what it was like. And it's going to get like that again. And by the way, Hezbollah has now occupied Lebanon. And the Middle East is not a friendly place for Christians to live. And it wasn't then in the 1920s when my granddad left. So what did he expect when he went to write a book?
I did not know what to expect. When I started putting things to paper, I kind of let memories flow, and I had no idea whether I had enough for a book or a short story or a little 10-page memoirs that I would just keep in the family. And when recollections flowed, they brought, dragged with them other recollections. And when eventually they stopped dragging new recollections and I stopped, I counted there were 250 scenes, kind of picture a scene in a movie, flashback of a particular event, certain people doing certain things. That was a scene, that was a page. There were 250 such pages, 250 such scenes. So I kind of figured by the time I embellish those and drop some of them and combine some of them, it's going to be a book length story, and it turned out to be right that. But I had no idea whether I'm going to end up with 10 of those scenes or 500 of them.
And so Andy, well, he tried to learn how to be a writer, and he was inspired by one writer in particular. And anybody who has ever read Frank McCourt's book, Angela's Hazards, or seen the movie version, will know why Andy Grove says what he says right here. There is an author who inspired him. And by the way, Frank McCourt was an English teacher. He wasn't a professional writer. And the memoir of his early childhood in Ireland is what inspired, it turns out, Andy Grove to write this memoir. Let's take a listen.
Angela's Ashes was my role model. By the way, in all fairness, I should mention that I read Angela's Ashes around the time I started thinking about the book, about writing a book like that. And then I read the story of this Irish boy, young man, who comes to America at age 20 and parallels my story in many ways. And what grabbed me is the masterful way Frank McCourt tells that story from the perspective of a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 12-year-old. And I was looking at it and I wonder if I can do that. So the competitive juices started flowing a little. And not that I ever pretend to reach, I mean, the man is a pro lyrical writer and, you know, I'm an engineer turned into writer, so I can't hope to equal him, but that was my role model.
And that is true. If you read McCourt's book, usually when there's a narrator in a book, the narrator's fixed in a place and time. But what was fascinating, McCourt, is when McCourt's a young boy, well, he's seeing everything from the young boy. When he's an older boy, he's an older boy. And the narrator's viewpoint flows straight through the book. And you're walking through his own life with him. And through that narrator's point of view. And when we come back, we're going to dig into more. And there's moments in this next segment where Andy Grove has to hold back some tears. You're also going to hear Charlie Rose ask what I call bromide questions. And he's a great interviewer. But every once in a while, he's Captain Obvious. And he asks questions that, well, Andy Grove has to push back on. Because they just make no sense. And it'll teach all of us to maybe not ask certain questions to people who've lived through profoundly difficult things. Like closure, words like closure, you'll get over it. You know, silly stuff we sometimes say to people because we're just not thinking things through. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories for the Hour, the life of Andy Grove. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're listening to the life of Andy Grove from Andy Grove's own mouth. He's being interviewed by Charlie Rose in 2001, the book, his memoir, Swimming Across. Actually, far more interesting than any of his business books. No disrespect to those business books. So this was right around the time of 9/11. And obviously, Andy Grove had lived through two wars, the Cold War, which was a real war to him. It wasn't some idea. People forget. The Russians invaded countries, took them over, and imprisoned people. And they're now modern European states. And it was only 50 or 60 years ago, folks. And Charlie Rose is wondering, what's your reaction when those towers fell? Let's take a listen.
September 11th came. A battle against terrorism. Did you say, oh my God?
I said, oh my God, but I said one more thing.
One more thing.
Do I have to go through this again? A moment of, I had to have to admit self-pity.
Self-pity?
Yeah, I mean, September 11 wasn't about me. September 11 was about thousands of people who died and tens of thousands of family members and the like. And so, you know, I have to admit that it was a self-centered thought, but I looked at it, you know, I've been through a war, world war, I've been through revolutions, been through repression, now this. So that was my immediate reaction. And subsequent in conversations, I found that from other people who have gone through the war, that there's a common reaction.
Oh my God, here come, then do I have to do this again?
Yeah.
And at this point, Charlie Rose asked one of those questions I was talking about. You know, that old line, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, Charlie digs into this space and take a listen to Andy Grove's very wise reaction to that question.
I don't see the connection between these events and how it turned out.
You know, no causal fact, relationship.
I don't think so. Just kind of just a common sense look at it. Millions of people went through the same experience. Thousands of people went through the same experience who ended up in my field, in my business or related businesses. They all turned out differently. They all led different lives. We are individuals who, when put into the crucible of a certain set of events, a certain environment, our makeup plus that crucible result in an adult of a particular brand, particular kind. So I don't think you can draw too many analogies. I know it's tempting because everybody tries to do that. But
well, that's what they expected they would understand. You know that.
Yeah.
But you don't see it.
I don't see it.
Is it because you don't know who? I mean, do you think you understand who Andy is and what makes Andy tick yourself? Or is that the kind of thing that you becoming, because you're an engineer,
I don't
would not have any interest in you. Understanding who I am and what makes me tick and why I am the way I am just has little interest.
It has little interest, and if it had any interest in it, I would be very dubious of my ability to sort these things out. You know, I'm really more interested in what to do next and how to approach certain things than to reflect on the imponderable.
Not a guy who looks backward.
Well, I can't say I'm not a guy to look
backward. Well,
in fact,
you were a good guy.
I just did, but not from an analytical standpoint, more from telling the story.
Telling the story.
It's a story meant for a particular audience, my own family, present and future. And it's a story meant to be a story of me and through me of a time and a place.
Yeah, there's often, you know, in the beginning you didn't hear the question, but Charlie Rose had basically said, you know, do you subscribe to those things that don't kill you make you stronger? And you had to see the look on Andy Grove's face. And I think that when people go through a tragedy and people will say to somebody, things will get better soon. Or you'll just say some things, and sometimes you just say nothing, you know? And meaning doesn't always come from these things. You just have to get through them. But just shut up. And Charlie just, I think, overstepped a bound there, and Andy Grove's reaction was gentlemanly and courtly. But you saw the look on his face, like, Charlie, you've obviously never been through anything really, really hard, like a Holocaust. It didn't make me stronger. So tell a story that's not in the book, Andy.
It had to do with me fainting once as a teenager. Went to an outhouse with a friend of mine, a close friend of mine that I described in the book. And there was a very windy day, and the wind slammed the outhouse door on my foot, scraped it in a very painful way, and I collapsed in the outhouse from the shock of the pain.
Yeah.
And I described my reaction coming to and kind of realizing that there was a black hole in my life while I fainted. I couldn't tell whether it was 2 seconds or 2 days.
Yes.
And my own indignation over blacking out and scared and this and that, I mean, it's no big deal, which is why I took it out in the editing. But my wife liked it so well that she thought it was somehow very much me. So I surrendered. I'm going to put it back.
Passing out in an outhouse for a couple of days? Yeah, I'd want to put that back in the story, too. Here's Charlie asking Andy Grove about something he experienced firsthand, totalitarianism. Does Andy Grove have any special insight about such things?
With respect to the experiences, one is totalitarianism, fascism, dictatorships, control, governments that occupy, impose their will, absence of freedom of expression, discrimination against religious and ethnic groups. Are you smart about this? I mean, you've gone through this. Does it make you, do you have some sense of being more nervous about it, more fearful of it, more
sensitive about it? I'm very aware of what it is like to be a minority that's picked upon. And I'm going to give you an example since you brought up the September 11 and its aftermath. I was horrified over what happened. I was depressed over what happened. But very soon after that, I started worrying about all those poor Middle Easterns who are going to get singled out, who have nothing whatsoever to do with it. They're going to be singled out because they are part of an ethnic group that has something to do with this. And sure enough, some incidents happened along that line, but I kind of anticipated that they would, and I really felt for them. I think I felt for them because I kind of knew, there for the grace of God go I have gone. I'm pretty sensitive to that. I'm pretty sensitive to accepting people as individuals as a result of probably the reaction to not having been accepted as an individual.
What a great quote. If that's what totalitarian gave him, it was a sensitivity to individuals. And we're talking about Andy Grove, who died recently, the Intel chief who spurred a semiconductor revolution, or as one of Greg's friends shared with us, the guy who created all that stuff in our computers, and that stuff that powered our computers. And again, created a revolution that allows us to do all the things we do, to communicate the way we communicate, and to drive the cost of things we care about lower and lower and lower. Because Moore's Law, well, Moore was one of the three men at Intel, and Moore's Law was that every 2 years, things would get just as fast as the last two. And that's why our TVs keep getting bigger, our computers keep getting smaller and faster, and everything keeps getting cheaper and better, too. And by the way, we wish that could be in all walks of life, like education and like health, the two areas that government controls. By the way, Andy Grove had a lot to say about that. as he was dying from a disease he wanted to help cure. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. One final segment with Andy Grove of Intel.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we are closing out the hour. An hour you just got to spend, and no one else, by the way, is doing this hour in radio. And if a man deserved it in this country, just his story alone, how he came to this country, is worth an hour. But my goodness, what he did with his life at Intel and what kind of a boss he is. We're going to get into that in a bit. We just want to close out this interview with Charlie Rose about his childhood and his memoir, Swimming Across. Charlie asks Andy about his tough early life. And again, that weird question.
Do you believe in this little notion that that doesn't kill me makes me stronger?
Only somebody who hasn't gone through would come up with a phrase like that.
It doesn't do that.
I don't know if it does or not, but it's a very, very pitiful consolation prize.
That's not worth it.
You the thought that the way I would complete that sentence, that one doesn't kill you, might very well have. I don't recommend it as a treatment for strength building.
Rose asks who the heroes were in this book.
Who are the heroes here?
In the book?
Mm-hmm.
My mother, my father. I had a very supportive set of parents, one of whom wasn't around during the most critical years. He was fighting for his own life. Russian prison right. Camp. My mother, I dedicate a book to my mother. I say in the dedication that for giving me life more than once, and I mean exactly that. My mother sheltered me from the worst of the war.
Sent you away.
Hid me.
Right.
Nurtured me. Protected me. Protected me by teaching me how to act and how to respond to certain things at a ridiculously young age. Acted as my father was gone for 3 to 4 years during the toughest period of time. Acted as the head of our family. It's kind of hard to come up with a hero that comes close to that.
You bet. So why did Andy Grove succeed, Charlie Rose wondered. Grove gives a great and really genuinely humble answer.
I'll answer that, but don't dismiss my answer. I was extraordinarily lucky. I give you an example of my luck. I got out of school, went to work at Fairchild. My first assignment was having to do with the analysis of the basic transistor structure, device structure, out of which modern integrated circuits are made. It was a brand new field. Somebody had the thought of putting me on the foundation work of the brand new field. Weeks out of school, I was one of the world's experts on a nascent emerging field in which there were no experts, so therefore, because I knew something about it, I became one of the experts. I was lucky because I got involved with Gordon Moore, who saw things in me that I didn't see in myself. I had the opportunity to follow him to Intel as a consequently. Now, you know, I'm kind of a persnickety fellow. I make the most of whatever opportunities I have. So I'm not saying I didn't work at these, but I made some choices that I didn't have the right to be as lucky about in terms of career. I had some breaks. I had some people like the Professor Schmidt that I describe in the book, like my PhD advisor, Andy Akervos, like Gordon Moore, who have nurtured me and supported me in a completely unselfish fashion along my career. What other word can you put on that luck?
And Charlie Rose was a little bit stunned. He thought Andy was soft-shoeing it, so Rose follows that up.
What was it? Someone once said that luck is where preparation meets opportunity.
That's approximately true, but the way I see it is you, for the most part, you can't create opportunity, but when life provides you with opportunity, it's up to you to make the most of that opportunity, and I try to do that. But I'm very mindful that had I not had one or several of those opportunities, the same characteristics, the same perseverance, the same hard work wouldn't have led to the same results.
So where did the title of his memoir, Swimming Across, come from?
Someplace in the middle of high school, the equivalent to high school, there was a parent-teacher conference where my favorite high school teacher, Mr. Volensky, who was my physics teacher, the real character of a guy, was haranguing the assorted parents in the room and told the story. He says, ladies and gentlemen, life is a lake, like a lake. And all these youngsters get in one side of the lake and they all start swimming. And not every one of them are going to make it across. In fact, in this class, I'm only sure of one guy that's going to make it across, and that's, I said my name in Hungarian. So my parents came home and told me the story, really, really pleased and proud. And that kind of became a metaphorical story.
Making it across.
Making it across, swimming across.
Swimming across. I'm glad you did this. I really am.
And the interview closes out with Charlie Rose holding up the book, and there's a picture. And Rose points to a smaller picture inside the bigger picture and to the corner of Gro's book. Take a listen.
If you look at this cute little kid here, there is something else there, which is in faint visibility. What?
The words of my father that he wrote on the back of some old pictures while he was very, very ill in prison camp. He thought he was dying. He was saying goodbye to my mother and myself. And as it turns out, he did not die. And he brought those pictures home, and I have them in my possession. And those are the words of his goodbye.
Probably the most prized possession you have, I guess.
Yes.
Thank you.
And you don't get to hear interviews like that. It was low-key. He wasn't pushing out personality or charisma. It was just a heartfelt, really remarkable interview. If you ever want to watch this in its entirety, just go on to Google, hit Charlie Rose, hit Andy Grove, put in Swimming Across, and you'll be moved. And I hope you were by that audio, and we were. And to know what the import of this man was to the world that we live in, Michael Malone, one of the great writers on business in this country, had recently written a book about Intel, and he called it The Intel Trinity. Let's take a listen to Michael Malone talking about this company and its importance in American life.
The question I get most in all the interviews on the book is, how dare I suggest that Intel is the most important company in the world? And everyone says, well, you know, they haven't done that well these last 5 years, and, you know, why not Facebook? It's got a million members, and why not Google? Because it's the access point to the Internet. And what I always tell them is, if tomorrow morning the employees of Intel just decided to sleep in, that they were tired of doing Moore's Law for 50 years, that all of this would just grind to a halt. I mean, it might take 10 years, but we live in a world defined by Moore's Law. And Intel is the, you know, it's the high church of Moore's Law, and they're the high priests. They're committed to the death to keep Moore's Law moving forward. And it gives us the world we live in of constant change and, you know, accelerated reality and all the things we become accustomed to. But it's not a law. It's a contract. It's a social contract. Intel is essentially, and the other companies that are now in the biz, you know, Samsung and Qualcomm and all the rest, they've made a commitment to keep this thing going, to drive the technology forward. They don't have to do it. And if they decide they don't want to do it anymore, all of this ends.
All of it ends. Here's a story. Intel Senior Vice President Ron Whittier notes that Grove preferred to keep open channels of communication between employees and encourage people to speak their minds. Quote, "People here aren't afraid to speak up and debate with Andy. They term this style, quote, constructive confrontation." We learned this about Justice Scalia, too. He wanted his associates and his clerks to argue with him. According to Grove's successor at Intel, Craig Barrett, quote, "It's give and take, and anyone in the company can yell at him. He's not above it." Grove insisted that people be demanding on one another, which fostered an atmosphere of, quote, ruthless intelligence. Story two. Gordon Moore and Andy Grove say their biggest accomplishment is that in a fast-moving competitive industry, their company has survived. Quote, "There were 50 other startups, more or less, in the semiconductor industry," Moore says. "We're about the only ones still around. It might be because they weren't into making a quick profit." There are two words that make him cringe. Exit strategy. He says, "I hate that." Grove says too many young tech entrepreneurs and venture capitalists want to sell their companies or go public, get rich, and get out. "I really don't much have respect for the people who live their lives motivated by an exit strategy, existing, being performed," he says. "There was no option that we were trained in that says, if it gets too hard, get up and leave." Andy Grove, you're learning a lot about his early life and in these quotes about the kind of man he was and the kind of company he ran. He wasn't in it for an exit. He was a lifer. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Andy Grove.